The Forever War, Disc 3.
I hardly heard him for trying to keep track of what was going on in my skull. I knew it was just post-hypnotic suggestion, even remembered the session in Missouri when they'd implanted it, but that didn't make it any less compelling. My mind reeled under the strong pseudo-memories, shaggy hulks that were Torrens, not at all what we now knew they looked like, boarding a colonist's vessel, eating babies while mothers watched in screaming terror. The colonists never took babies. They wouldn't stand the acceleration. Then raping the women to death with huge veined purple members. Ridiculous that they would feel desire for humans. Holding the men down while they plucked flesh from their living bodies and gobbled it, as if they could assimilate the alien protein. 100 grisly details as sharply remembered as the events of a minute ago, ridiculously overdone and logically absurd. But while my conscious mind was rejecting the silliness, somewhere much deeper, down in that sleeping animal where we keep our real motives and morals, something was thirsting for alien blood, secure in the conviction that the noblest thing a man could do would be to die killing one of those horrible monsters. I knew it was all purest soya shit, and I hated the men who had taken such obscene liberties with my mind. But I could even hear my teeth grinding, feel my cheeks frozen in a spastic grin. Bloodlust. A teddy bear walked in front of me looking dazed. I started to raise my laser finger, but somebody beat me to it, and the creature's head exploded in a cloud of gray splinters and blood. Lucky groaned, half whining. "Dirty, filthy fucking bastards!" Lasers flared and crisscrossed, and all of the teddy bears fell dead.
"Watch it, goddammit!" Cortez screamed. "Aim those fucking things. They aren't toys. Time, move out into the craters to cover B."
Somebody was laughing and sobbing.
"What the fuck is wrong with you, Petrov?"
Strange to hear Cortez cussing. I twisted around and saw Petrov, behind and to my left, lying in a shallow hole, digging frantically with both hands, crying and gurgling.
"Fuck," Cortez said. "Team B, 10 meters past the crater, get down in a line. Team C, into the craters with A."
I scrambled up and covered the 100 meters in 12 amplified strides. The craters were practically large enough to hide a scout ship, some 10 meters in diameter. I jumped to the opposite side of the hole and landed next to a fellow named Chin. He didn't even look around when I landed, just kept scanning the base for signs of life.
"Team A, 10 meters past Team B, down in line."
Just as he finished, the building in front of us burped, and a salvo of the bubbles fanned out toward our lines. Most people saw it coming and got down, but Chin was just getting up to make his rush, and stepped right into one. It grazed the top of his helmet and disappeared with a faint pop. He took one step backwards and toppled over the edge of the crater, trailing an arc of blood and brains. Lifeless, spread-eagled, he slid halfway to the bottom, shoveling dirt into the perfectly symmetrical hole where the bubble had chewed indiscriminately through plastic, hair, skin, bone, and brain.
"Everybody hold it. Platoon leaders, casualty report. Check. Check, check. Check, check, check. Check. We have 3 deaders. Wouldn't be any if you'd have kept low. So everybody grab dirt when you hear that thing go off. Team A, complete the rush."
They completed the maneuver without incident.
"Okay, Team C, rush to where B... Hold it! Down!"
Everybody was already hugging the ground. The bubbles slid by in a smooth arc about 2 meters off the ground. They went serenely over our heads, and except for one that made toothpicks out of a tree, disappeared in the distance.
"B, Rush past A 10 meters. C, take over B's place. You B grenadiers, see if you can reach the flower.
Two grenades tore up the ground 30 or 40 meters from the structure. In a good imitation of panic, it started belching out a continuous stream of bubbles, still none coming lower than 2 meters off the ground. We kept hunched down and continued to advance. Suddenly a seam appeared in the building and widened to the size of a large door. Torrens came swarming out.
Grenadiers, hold your fire. B-team, laser fire to the left and right. Keep 'em bunched up. A and C, rush down the center.
One Torren died trying to run through a laser beam. The others stayed where they were. In a suit, it's pretty awkward to run and keep your head down at the same time. You have to go from side to side, like a skater getting started. Otherwise, you'll be airborne. At least one person, somebody in A-team, bounced too high and suffered the same fate as Chin. I was feeling pretty fenced in and trapped, with a wall of laser fire on each side and a low ceiling that meant death to touch. But in spite of myself, I felt happy, euphoric, finally getting the chance to kill some of those villainous baby eaters, knowing it was Soya shit. They weren't fighting back, except for the rather ineffective bubbles, obviously not designed as an anti-personnel weapon. And they didn't retreat back into the building, either. They milled around, about 100 of them, and watched us get closer. A couple of grenades would caulk them all, but I guess Cortez was thinking about the prisoner. Okay, when I say go, we're going to flank 'em. B-team will hold fire. Second and fourth platoons to the right, sixth and seventh to the left. B-team will move forward in a line to box them in. Go! We peeled off to the left. As soon as the lasers stopped, the Torrens bolted, running in a group on a collision course with our flank.
A-team, down and fire. Don't shoot until you're sure of your aim. If you miss, you might hit a friendly. And for Christ's sake, save me one.
It was a horrifying sight, that herd of monsters bearing down on us. They were running in great leaps, the bubbles avoiding them, and they all looked like the one we saw earlier, riding the broomstick, naked except for an almost transparent sphere around their whole bodies that moved along with them. The right flank started firing, picking off individuals in the rear of the pack. Suddenly a laser flared through the Torrens from the other side, somebody missing his mark. There was a horrible scream, and I looked down the line to see someone, I think it was Perry, writhing on the ground, right hand over the smoldering stump of his arm, seared off just below the elbow. Blood sprayed through his fingers, and the suit, its camouflage circuits scrambled, flickered, black, white, jungle, desert, green, gray. I don't know how long I stared, long enough for the medic to run over and start giving aid, but when I looked up, the Torrens were almost on top of me. My first shot was wild and high, but it grazed the top of the leading Torren's protective bubble. The bubble disappeared, and the monster stumbled and fell to the ground, jerking spasmodically. Foam gushed out of his mouth hole, first white, then streaked red. With one last jerk, he became rigid and twisted backwards, almost to the shape of a horseshoe. His long scream, a high-pitched whistle, stopped just as his comrades trampled over him. I hated myself for smiling. It was slaughter. Even though our flank was outnumbered 5-1, they kept coming without faltering, even when they had to climb over the drift of bodies and parts of bodies that piled up high, parallel to our flank. The ground between us was slick red with Torren blood. All God's children got hemoglobin. And, like the teddy bears, their guts looked pretty much like guts to my untrained eye. My helmet reverberated with hysterical laughter while we slashed them to gory chunks, and I almost didn't hear Cortez.
Hold your fire. I said, hold it, goddammit. Catch a couple of the bastards. They won't hurt you.
I stopped shooting, and eventually so did everybody else. When the next Torin jumped over the smoking pile of meat in front of me, I dove to try to tackle him around those spindly legs. It was like hugging a big slippery balloon. When I tried to drag him down, he popped out of my arms and kept running. We managed to stop one of them by the simple expedient of piling half a dozen people on top of him. By that time, the others had run through our line and were headed for the row of large cylindrical tanks that Cortez had said were probably for storage. A little door had opened in the base of each one.
"We've got our prisoner," Cortez shouted. "Kill!"
They were 50 meters away and running hard, difficult targets. Lasers slashed around them, bobbing high and low. One fell, sliced in two, but the others, about 10 of them, kept going and were almost to the doors when the grenadiers started firing. They were still loaded with 500 mic bombs, but a near miss wasn't enough. The concussion would just send them flying, unhurt, in their bubbles.
"The buildings! Get the fucking buildings!"
The grenadiers raised their aim and let fly, but the bombs only seemed to scorch the white outside of the structures, until by chance one landed in a door. That split the building just as if it had a seam. The two halves popped away, and a cloud of machinery flew into the air, accompanied by a huge pale flame that rolled up and disappeared in an instant. Then the others all concentrated on the doors, except for pot shots at some of the Torrens, not so much to get them as to blow them away before they could get inside. They seemed awfully eager. All this time we were trying to get the Torrens with laser fire, while they weaved and bounced around trying to get into the structures. We moved in as close to them as we could without putting ourselves in danger from the grenade blasts, yet too far away for good aim. Still, we were getting them one by one, and managed to destroy 4 of the 7 buildings. Then, when there were only 2 aliens left, a nearby grenade blast flung one of them to within a few meters of a door. He dove in, and several grenadiers fired salvos after him, but they all fell short or detonated harmlessly on the side. Bombs were falling all around, making an awful racket, but the sound was suddenly drowned out by a great sigh, like a giant's intake of breath, and where the building had been was a thick, cylindrical cloud of smoke, solid-looking, dwindling away into the stratosphere, straight as if laid down by a ruler. The other Torin had been right at the base of the cylinder. I could see pieces of him flying. A second later, a shock wave hit us, and I rolled helplessly, pinwheeling, to smash into the pile of Torin bodies and roll beyond. I picked myself up and panicked for a second when I saw there was blood all over my suit. When I realized it was only alien blood, I relaxed, but felt unclean.
"Catch the bastard! Catch him!"
In the confusion, the Torin had gotten free and was running for the grass. One platoon was chasing after him, losing ground, but then all of B-team ran over and cut him off. I jogged over to join in the fun. There were 4 people on top of him, and a ring around them of about 50 people, watching the struggle.
"Spread out, damn it! There might be 1,000 more of them waiting to get us in one place."
We dispersed, grumbling. By unspoken agreement, we were all sure that there were no more live Torrens on the face of the planet. Cortez was walking toward the prisoner, while I backed away. Suddenly, the 4 men collapsed in a pile on top of the creature. Even from my distance, I could see the foam spouting from his mouth hole. His bubble had popped. Suicide.
"Damn!"
Cortez was right there.
"Get off that bastard."
The 4 men got off, and Cortez used his laser to slice the monster into a dozen quivering chunks. Heartwarming sight.
That's all right, though. We'll find another one. Everybody, back in the Arrowhead formation. Combat assault on the flower.
Well, we assaulted the flower, which had evidently run out of ammunition. It was still belching, but no bubbles. And it was empty. We scurried up ramps and through corridors, fingers at the ready, like kids playing soldier. There was nobody home. The same lack of response at the antenna installation, the Salami, and 20 other major buildings, as well as the 44 perimeter huts, still intact. So we had captured dozens of buildings, mostly of incomprehensible purpose, but failed in our main mission, capturing a Tauren for the xenologists to experiment with. Oh well, they could have all the bits and pieces they'd ever want. That was something. After we'd combed every last square centimeter of the base, a scout ship came in with the real exploration crew, the scientists. Cortez said, "All right, snap out of it." And the hypnotic compulsion fell away. At first, it was pretty grim. A lot of the people, like Lucky and Mary Gay, almost went crazy with the memories of bloody murder multiplied 100 times. Cortez ordered everybody to take a sed tab, 2 for the ones most upset. I took 2 without being specifically ordered to do so. Because it was murder. Unadorned butchery. Once we had the anti-spacecraft weapon doped out, we hadn't been in any danger. The Taurans hadn't seemed to have any conception of person-to-person fighting. We had just herded them up and slaughtered them. The first encounter between mankind and another intelligent species. Maybe it was the second encounter, counting the teddy bears. What might have happened if we had sat down and tried to communicate? But they got the same treatment. I spent a long time after that telling myself over and over that it hadn't been me who so gleefully carved up those frightened, stampeding creatures. Back in the 20th century, they had established, to everybody's satisfaction, that I was just following orders was an inadequate excuse for inhuman conduct. But what can you do when the orders come from deep down in that puppet master of the unconscious? Worst of all was the feeling that perhaps my actions weren't all that inhuman. Ancestors only a few generations back would have done the same thing, even to their fellow men, without any hypnotic conditioning. I was disgusted with the human race, disgusted with the army, and horrified at the prospect of living with myself for another century or so. Well, there was always brain wipe. A ship with a lone Tauren survivor had escaped and had gotten away clean, the bulk of the planet shielding it from Earth's hope while it dropped into Aleph's collapsar field. Escaped home, I guessed, wherever that was, to report what 20 men with hand weapons could do to 100 fleeing on foot, unarmed. I suspected that the next time humans met Taurans in ground combat, we would be more evenly matched. And I was right. Sergeant Mandela, 2007 to 2024 AD. Chapter 1. I was scared enough. Submajor Stott was pacing back and forth behind the small podium in the assembly room chop hall gymnasium of the anniversary. We had just made our final collapsar jump from Tet 38 to Yod 4. We were decelerating at 1.5 gravities, and our velocity relative to that collapsar was a respectable 0.90 C. We were being chased.
"I wish you people would relax for a while and just trust the ship's computer. The Tauren vessel, at any rate, will not be within strike range for another 2 weeks. Mandela?"
He was always very careful to call me Sergeant Mandela in front of the company, but everybody at this particular briefing was either a sergeant or a corporal. Squad leaders.
Yes, sir? You're responsible for the psychological as well as the physical well-being of the men and women in your squad, assuming that you are aware that there is a morale problem aboard this vessel. What have you done about it?
As far as my squad is concerned, sir?
Of course.
We talk it out, sir.
And have you arrived at any cogent conclusion?
Meaning no disrespect, sir, I think the major problem is obvious. My people have been cooped up in this ship for 14...
Ridiculous. Every one of us has been adequately conditioned against the pressures of living in close quarters, and the enlisted people have the privilege of confraternity.
This was a delicate way of putting it.
Officers must remain celibate, and yet we have no morale problem.
If he thought his officers were celibate, he should sit down and have a long talk with Lieutenant Harmony. Maybe he just meant line officers, though. That would be just him and Cortez. Probably 50% right. Cortez was awfully friendly with Corporal Kamehameha. Sir, perhaps it was the detoxification back at Stargate. Maybe...
No, the therapists only work to erase the hate conditioning. Everybody knows how I feel about that. And they may be misguided, but they are skilled. Corporal Potter?
He always called her by her rank to remind her why she hadn't been promoted as high as the rest of us. Too soft.
Have you talked it out with your people, too?
We've discussed it, sir. The sub-major could glare mildly at people. He glared mildly at Mary Gay until she elaborated. I don't believe it's the fault of the conditioning. My people are impatient, just tired of doing the same thing day after day.
They're anxious for combat, then?
No sarcasm in his voice. They want to get off the ship, sir.
They will get off the ship,
he said, allowing himself a microscopic smile.
And then they'll probably be just as impatient to get back on.
It went back and forth like that for a long while. Nobody wanted to come right out and say that their squad was scared. Scared of the Tauran cruiser closing on us. Scared of the landing on the portal planet. Submajor Stott had a bad record of dealing with people who admitted fear. I fingered the fresh table of organization they had given us. I knew most of the people from the raid on Aleph, the first face-to-face contact between humans and Taurans. The only new people in my platoon were Luthuli and Hirovsky. In the company as a whole, excuse me, the strike force, we had 20 replacements for the 19 people we lost from the Aleph raid, one amputation, 4 deaders, 14 psychotics. I couldn't get over the 20 March 2007 at the bottom of the TO. I'd been in the Army 10 years, though it felt like less than 2. Time dilation, of course. Even with the collapsar jumps, traveling from star to star eats up the calendar. After this raid, I would probably be eligible for retirement with full pay, if I lived through the raid, and if they didn't change the rules on us. Me, a 20-year man, and only 25 years old. Stott was summing up when there was a knock on the door, a single loud rap.
Enter, he said.
An ensign I knew vaguely walked in casually and handed Stott a slip of paper without saying a word. He stood there while Stott read it, slumping with just the right degree of insolence. Technically, Stott was out of his chain of command. Everybody in the Navy disliked him anyhow. Stott handed the paper back to the ensign and looked through him.
You will alert your squads that preliminary evasive maneuvers will commence at 20:10, 58 minutes from now.
He hadn't looked at his watch.
All personnel will be in acceleration shells by 20:00. Tinch, hut! We rose, and without enthusiasm, chorused, Fuck you, sir. Idiotic custom. Stott strode out of the room, and the ensign followed, smirking. I turned my ring to my assistant squad leader's position and talked into it. Tate, this is Mandela. Everyone else in the room was doing the same. A tinny voice came out of the ring. Tate here, what's up? Get a hold of the men and tell them we have to be in the shells by 20:00. Evasive maneuvers. Crap, they told us it would be days. I guess something new came up, or maybe the Commodore has a bright idea. The Commodore can stuff it. You up in the lounge? Yeah. Bring me back a cup when you come, okay? Little sugar? Roger, be down in about half an hour. Thanks, I'll get on it. There was a general movement toward the coffee machine. I got in line behind Corporal Potter. What do you think, Mary Gay? Maybe the Commodore just wants us to try out the shells once more. Before the real thing. Maybe. She picked up a cup and blew into it. She looked worried. Or maybe the Torrens had a ship way out waiting for us. I've wondered why they don't do it. We do at Stargate. Stargate's a different thing. It takes 7 cruisers moving all the time to cover all the possible exit angles. We can't afford to do it for more than 1 collapsar, and neither could they. She didn't say anything while she filled her cup. Maybe we've stumbled on their version of Stargate, or maybe they have more ships than we do by now. I filled and sugared 2 cups, sealed one. No way to tell. We walked back to a table, careful with the cups and the high gravity. Maybe Singh knows something, she said. Maybe he does, but I'd have to get him through Rogers and Cortez. Cortez would jump down my throat if I tried to bother him now. Oh, I can get him directly. She dimpled a little bit. We've been friends. I sipped some scalding coffee and tried to sound nonchalant. So that's where you've been disappearing to. You disapprove? She said, looking innocent. Well, damn it, no, of course not, but he's an officer, a Navy officer. He's attached to us, and that makes him part Army. She twisted her ring and said, Directory? To me. What about you and little Miss Harmony? That's not the same thing. She was whispering a directory code into the ring. Yes, it is. You just wanted to do it with an officer, pervert. The ring bleated twice. Busy. How was she? Adequate. I was recovering. Besides, Ensign Singh is a perfect gentleman, and not the least bit jealous. Neither am I said. If he ever hurts you, tell me and I'll break his ass. She looked at me across her cup. If Lieutenant Harmony ever hurts you, tell me and I'll break her ass. It's a deal. We shook on it, solemnly. Chapter 2. The acceleration shells were something new, installed while we rested and resupplied at Stargate. They enabled us to use the ship at closer to its theoretical efficiency, the tachyon drive boosting it to as much as 25 gravities. Tate was waiting for me in the shell area. The rest of the squad was milling around, talking. I gave him his coffee. Thanks. Find out anything? Afraid not, except the swabbies don't seem to be scared, and it's their show. Probably just another practice run. He slurped some coffee. What the hell, it's all the same to us anyhow. Just sit there and get squeezed half to death. God, I hate those things. Maybe they'll eventually make us obsolete and we can go home. Sure thing. The medic came by and gave me my shot.
I waited until 1950 and hollered to the squad, "Let's go, strip down and zip up." The shell is like a flexible spacesuit. At least the fittings on the inside are pretty similar. But instead of a life support package, there's a hose going into the top of the helmet and two coming out of the heels, as well as two relief tubes per suit. They're crammed in shoulder to shoulder on light acceleration couches. Getting to your shell is like picking your way through a giant plate of olive drab spaghetti. When the lights in my helmet showed that everybody was suited up, I pushed the button that flooded the room. No way to see, of course, but I could imagine the pale blue solution. Ethylene glycol, and something else, foaming up around and over us. The suit material, cool and dry, collapsed in to touch my skin at every point. I knew that my internal body pressure was increasing rapidly to match the increasing fluid pressure outside. That's what the shot was for. Keep your cells from getting squished between the devil and the deep blue sea. You could still feel it, though. By the time my meter said 2, external pressure equivalent to a column of water 2 nautical miles deep, I felt that I was at the same time being crushed and bloated. By 2005, it was at 2.7 and holding steady. When the maneuvers began at 2010, you couldn't feel the difference. I thought I saw the needle fluctuate a tiny bit, though. The major drawback to the system is that, of course, anybody caught outside of his shell when the anniversary hit 25 Gs would be just so much strawberry jam. So the guiding and the fighting have to be done by the ship's tactical computer, which does most of it anyway, but it's nice to have a human overseer. Another small problem is that if the ship gets damaged and the pressure drops, you'll explode like a dropped melon. If it's the internal pressure, you get crushed to death in a microsecond. And it takes 10 minutes, more or less, to get depressurized, and another 2 or 3 to get untangled and dressed. So it's not exactly something you can hop out of and come up fighting. The accelerating was over at 2038. A green light went on, and I chinned the button to depressurize. Mary Gay and I were getting dressed outside. "How'd that happen?" I pointed to an angry purple welt that ran from the bottom of her right breast to her hip bone. "That's the second time," she said, mad. "The first one was on my back. I think that shell doesn't fit right, gets creases."
"Maybe you've lost weight."
"Wise guy." Our caloric intake had been rigorously monitored ever since we left Stargate the first time. You can't use a fighting suit unless it fits you like a second skin. A wall speaker drowned out the rest of her comment.
"Attention all personnel, attention. All Army personnel, echelon 6 and above, and all Navy personnel, echelon 4 and above, will report to the briefing room at 2130. It repeated the message twice. I went off to lie down for a few minutes, while Mary Gay showed her bruise to the medic and the armorer. I didn't feel a bit jealous. The Commodore began the briefing. "There's not much to tell, and what there is not good news. 6 days ago, the Torren vessel that is pursuing us released a drone missile. Its initial acceleration was on the order of 80 gravities. After blasting for approximately a day, its acceleration suddenly jumped to 148 gravities.
Collective gasp.
Yesterday, it jumped to 203 gravities. I shouldn't need to remind anyone here that this is twice the accelerative capability of the enemy's drones in our last encounter. We launched a salvo of drones, 4 of them, intersecting what the computer predicted to be the 4 most probable future trajectories of the enemy drone. One of them paid off.
while we were doing evasive maneuvers. We contacted and destroyed the Torran weapon about 10 million kilometers from here. That was practically next door. The only encouraging thing we learned from the encounter was from spectral analysis of the blast. It was no more powerful an explosion than ones we have observed in the past, so at least their progress in propulsion hasn't been matched by progress in explosives. This is the first manifestation of a very important effect that has heretofore been of interest only to theorists. Tell me, soldier. He pointed at Negulesco. How long has it been since we first fought the Torrens at Aleph?
That depends on your frame of reference, Commodore, she answered dutifully. To me, it's been about 8 months.
Exactly. You've lost about 9 years, though, to time dilation while we maneuvered between collapsar jumps. In an engineering sense, as we haven't done any important research and development aboard ship, that enemy vessel comes from our future.
He paused to let that sink in.
As the war progresses, this can only become more and more pronounced. The Torrens don't have any cure for relativity, of course, so it will be to our benefit as often as to theirs. For the present, though, it is we who are operating with a handicap. As the Torran pursuit vessel draws closer, this handicap will become more severe. They can simply outshoot us. We're going to have to do some fancy dodging. When we get within 500 million kilometers of the enemy ship, everybody gets in his shell, and we just have to trust the logistic computer. It will put us through a rapid series of random changes in direction and velocity. I'll be blunt. As long as they have one more drone than we, they can finish us off. They haven't launched any more since that first one. Perhaps they are holding their fire, or maybe they only had one. In that case, it's we who have them. At any rate, all personnel will be required to be in their shells with no more than 10 minutes' notice. When we get within 1,000 million kilometers of the enemy, you are to stand by your shells. And by the time we are within 500 million kilometers, you will be in them, and all shell compounds flooded and pressurized. We cannot wait for anyone. That's all I have to say. Submajor?
I'll speak to my people later, Commodore. Thank you.
Dismissed. And none of this fuck you, sir, nonsense. The Navy thought that was just a little beneath their dignity. We stood at attention, all except Stott, until he had left the room. Then some other swabby said, "Dismissed," again, and we left. My squad had cleanup detail, so I told everybody who was to do what, put tainted charge, and left. Went up to the NCO room for some company and maybe some information. There wasn't much happening but idle speculation, so I took Rogers and went off to bed. Mary Gay had disappeared again, hopefully trying to wheedle something out of Sing.
Chapter 3. We had our promised get-together with the sub-major the next morning, when he more or less repeated what the Commodore had said, in infantry terms, and in his staccato monotone. He emphasized the fact that all we knew about the Torran ground forces was that if their naval capability was improved, it was likely they would be able to handle us better than last time. But that brings up an interesting point. 8 months or 9 years before, we'd had a tremendous advantage. They had seemed not quite to understand what was going on. As belligerent as they had been in space, we'd expected them to be real Huns on the ground. Instead, they practically lined themselves up for slaughter. One escaped, and presumably described the idea of old-fashioned infighting to his fellows. But that, of course, didn't mean that the word had necessarily gotten to this particular bunch, the Torrens guarding Yod 4. The only way we know of to communicate faster than the speed of light
is to physically carry a message through successive collapsar jumps, and there was no way of telling how many jumps there were between Yod 4 and the Torin home base, so these might be just as passive as the last bunch, or might have been practicing infantry tactics for most of a decade. We would find out when we got there. The armorer and I were helping my squad pull maintenance on their fighting suits when we passed the 1,000,000,000-kilometer mark and had to go up to the shells. We had about 5 hours to kill before we had to get into our cocoons. I played a game of chess with Robbie and lost. Then Rogers led the platoon in some vigorous calisthenics, probably for no other reason than to get their minds off the prospect of having to lie half-crushed in the shells for at least 4 hours. The longest we'd gone before was half that. 10 minutes before the 500,000,000-kilometer mark, we squad leaders took over and supervised buttoning everybody up. In 8 minutes, we were zipped and flooded, and at the mercy of, or safe in the arms of, the logistic computer. While I was lying there being squeezed, a silly thought took hold of my brain and went round and round like a charge in a superconductor. According to military formalism, the conduct of war divides neatly into two categories, tactics and logistics. Logistics has to do with moving troops and feeding them, and just about everything except the actual fighting, which is tactics. And now we're fighting, but we don't have a tactical computer to guide us through attack and defense, just a huge, super-efficient, pacifistic, cybernetic grocery clerk of a logistic, mark that word, logistic computer. The other side of my brain, perhaps not quite as pinched, would argue that it doesn't matter what name you give to a computer. It's a pile of memory crystals, logic banks, nuts and bolts. If you program it to be Genghis Khan, it is a tactical computer, even if its usual function is to monitor the stock market or control sewage conversion. But the other voice was obdurate and said, by that kind of reasoning, a man is only a hank of hair and a piece of bone and some stringy meat. And no matter what kind of a man he is, if you teach him well, you can take a Zen monk and turn him into a slavering, bloodthirsty warrior. Then what the hell are you? We. Am I? Answered the other side. A peace-loving, vacuum-welding specialist, come physics teacher, snatched up by the Elite Conscription Act and reprogrammed to be a killing machine. You, I have killed and liked it. But that was hypnotism, motivational conditioning, I argued back at myself. They don't do that anymore. And the only reason I said they don't do it is that they think you'll kill better without it. That's logic. Speaking of logic, the original question was, why do they send a logistic computer to do a man's job? Or something like that. And we were off again. The light blinked green, and I chinned the switch automatically. The pressure was down to 1.3 before I realized that it meant we were alive. We had won the first skirmish. I was only partly right. Chapter 4. I was belting on my tunic when my ring tingled, and I held it up to listen. It was Rogers. Mandela, go check Squad Bay 3. Something went wrong. Dalton had to depressurize it from control. Bay 3. That was Mary Gay's squad. I rushed down the corridor in bare feet and got there just as they opened the door from inside the pressure chamber and began straggling out. The first out was Bergman. I grabbed his arm. What the hell is going on, Bergman? Huh? He peered at me, still dazed, as everyone is when they come out of the chamber. Oh, sew, Mandela. I don't know. What do you mean? I squinted in through the door, still holding on to him. You were late, man. You depressurized late. What happened?
He shook his head, trying to clear it.
Late? What, late, how late?
I looked at my watch for the first time. Not two. Jesus Christ.
We zipped in at 0520, didn't we?
Yeah, I think that's it.
Still no Mary Gay among the dim figures picking their way through the ranked couches and jumbled tubing.
You were only a couple of minutes late, but we were only supposed to be under for 4 hours, maybe less. It's 10:50.
He shook his head again. I let go of him and stood back to let Stiller and Demi through the door.
Everybody's late, then, Bergman said.
So we aren't in any trouble?
Non sequiturs.
Right, right. Hey, Stiller, you seen...
From inside.
Medic! Medic!
Somebody who wasn't Mary Gay was coming out. I pushed her roughly out of my way and dove through the door, landed on somebody else, and clambered over to where Struve, Mary Gay's assistant, was standing over a pod and talking very loud and fast into his ring.
And blood! God, yes, we need...
It was Mary Gay. Still lying in her suit, she was...
Got the word from Dalton.
Covered every square inch of her with a uniform bright sheen of blood.
When she didn't come out...
It started as an angry welt up by her collarbone, and was just a welt as it traveled between her breasts until it passed the sternum support.
I came over and popped the...
And opened up into a cut that got deeper as it ran down over her belly, and where it stopped.
Yeah, she's still...
A few centimeters above the pubis, a membraned loop of gut was protruding.
Okay, left hip. Mandela?
She was still alive, her heart palpitating, but her blood-streaked head lolled limply, eyes rolled back to white slits, bubbles of red froth appearing and popping at the corner of her mouth each time she exhaled shallowly.
Tattooed on her left hip. Mandela, snap out of it! Reach under her and find out what her blood...
Type O, Rh negative. God damn
it. Sorry, O negative.
Hadn't I seen that tattoo 10,000 times? Struve passed this information on, and I suddenly remembered the first aid kit on my belt, snapped it off and fumbled through it. Stop the bleeding, protect the wound, treat for shock. That's what the book said. Forgot one. Clear air passages. She was breathing, if that's what they meant. How do you stop the bleeding or protect the wound with one measly pressure bandage when the wound is nearly a meter long? Treat for shock, that I could do. I fished out the green ampule, laid it against her arm, and pushed the button. Then I laid the sterile side of the bandage gently on top of the exposed intestine and passed the elastic strip under the small of her back, adjusted it for nearly zero tension, and fastened it.
Anything else you can do? Struve asked.
I stood back and felt helpless.
I don't know. Can you think of anything?
I'm no more of a medic than you are. Looking up at the door, he kneaded a fist, biceps straining.
Where the hell are they? You have Morphplex in that kit?
Yeah, but somebody told me not to use it for internal.
William?
Her eyes were open, and she was trying to lift her head. I rushed over and held her. It'll be all right, Mary Gay. The medic's coming.
What? All right? I'm thirsty. Water.
No, honey. You can't have any water. Not for a while, anyhow. Not if she was headed for surgery.
Why is all the blood?
She said in a small voice. Her head rolled back.
Been a bad girl.
It must have been the suit, I said rapidly. Remember earlier the creases? She shook her head.
Suit?
She turned suddenly paler and retched weakly.
Water. William, please.
Authoritative voice behind me.
Get a sponge or a cloth soaked in water. I looked around and saw Doc Wilson with two stretcher bearers. "First half-liter femoral," he said to no one in particular as he carefully peeked under the pressure bandage. "Follow that relief tube down a couple of meters and pinch it off. Find out if she's passed any blood." One of the medics ran a 10-centimeter needle into Mary Gay's thigh and started giving her whole blood from a plastic bag.
"Sorry, I'm late," Doc Wilson said tiredly. "Business is booming. What did you say about the suit?"
"She had two minor injuries before. Suit doesn't fit quite right, creases up under pressure."
He nodded absently, checking her blood pressure. Anybody give..."
Somebody handed him a paper towel dripping water.
Give her any medication?"
"One ampule of no shock." He wadded the paper towel up loosely and put it in Mary Gay's hand.
"What's her name?"
I told him.
"Mary Gay, we can't give you a drink of water, but you can suck on this. Now, I'm going to shine a bright light in your eye."
While he was looking through her pupil with a metal tube, he said,
"Temperature?"
And one of the medics read a number from a digital readout box and withdrew a probe.
"Passed blood?"
"Yes, some." He put his hand lightly on the pressure bandage.
"Mary Gay, can you roll over a little on your right side?"
"Yes," she said slowly and put her elbow down for leverage.
"No,"
she said and started crying.
"Now, now,"
he said absently and pushed up on her hip just enough to be able to see her back.
"Only the one wound," he muttered. "Hell of a lot of blood."
He pressed the side of his ring twice and shook it by his ear. "Anybody up in the shop?"
"Harrison, unless he's on a call."
A woman walked up, and at first I didn't recognize her. Pale and disheveled, blood-stained tunic. It was Estelle Harmony. Doc Wilson looked up.
"Any new customers, Dr. Harmony?"
"No," she said dully. "The maintenance man was a double traumatic amputation, only lived a few minutes. We're keeping him running for transplants."
"All those others?"
"Explosive decompression." She sniffed.
"Anything I can do here?"
"Yeah, just a minute." He tried his ring again.
"God damn it, you don't know where Harrison is?"
"No, well, maybe he might be in Surgery B if there was trouble with the cadaver maintenance. Think I set it up all right, though."
"Yeah, well, hell, you know how."
"Mark,"
said the medic with the blood bag. "One more half-liter femoral," Doc Wilson said.
"Estelle, you mind taking over for one of the medics here, prepare this gal for surgery?"
"No, keep me busy."
"Good. Hopkins, go up to the shop and bring down a roller and a liter, and 2 liters isotonic fluorocarb with the primary spectrum. If they're Merc, they'll say abdominal spectrum."
He found a part of his sleeve with no blood on it and wiped his forehead.
"If you find Harrison, send him over to Surgery A and have him set up the anesthetic sequence for abdominal."
"And bring her up to A?"
"Right. If you can't find Harrison, get somebody."
He stabbed a finger in my direction.
"This guy, to roll the patient up to A. You run ahead and start the sequence."
He picked up his bag and looked through it.
"We could start the sequence here," he muttered. "But hell, not with paramethadone."
"Mary Gay, how do you feel?"
She was still crying.
"I'm hurt."
"I know," he said gently.
He thought for a second and said to Estelle,
"No way to really tell how much blood she lost. She may have been passing it under pressure. Also, there's some pooling in the abdominal cavity. Since she's still alive, I don't think she could have bled under pressure for very long. Hope no brain damage yet."
He touched the digital readout attached to Mary Gay's arm. "Monitor the blood pressure, and if you think it's indicated, give her 5 cc's vasoconstrictor. I've got to go scrub down."
He closed his bag. "You have any vasoconstrictor besides the pneumatic ampule?"
Esther checked her own bag.
No, just the emergency pneumatic. Yes, I've got controlled dosage on the dilator, though.
Okay. If you have to use the constrictor and her pressure goes up too fast,
I'll give her vasodilator 2 cc's at a time.
Check. Hell of a way to run things, but... Well, if you're not too tired, I'd like you to stand by me upstairs.
Sure.
Doc Wilson nodded and left. Estelle began sponging Mary Gay's belly with isopropyl alcohol. It smelled cold and clean.
Somebody gave her no shock?
Yes, I said, about 10 minutes ago.
Ah, that's why the doc was worried.
No, you did the right thing, but no shock's got some vasoconstrictor. 5 cc's more might run up an overdose. She continued silently scrubbing, her eyes coming up every few seconds to check the blood pressure monitor.
William?
It was the first time she'd shown any sign of knowing me.
This Mary Gay, she's your lover, your regular lover?
That's right.
She's very pretty.
A remarkable observation, her body torn and caked with crusting blood, her face smeared where I had tried to wipe away the tears. I suppose a doctor or a woman or a lover can look beneath that and see beauty.
Yes, she is.
She had stopped crying and had her eyes squeezed shut, sucking the last bit of moisture from the paper wad.
Can she have some more water?
Okay, same as before, not too much. I went out to the locker alcove and into the head for a paper towel. Now that the fumes from the pressurizing fluid had cleared, I could smell the air. It smelled wrong. Light machine oil and burnt metal, like the smell of a metalworking shop. I wondered whether they had overloaded the airco. That had happened once before, after the first time we'd used the acceleration chambers. Mary Gay took the water without opening her eyes.
Do you plan to stay together when you get back to Earth?
Probably, I said. If we get back to Earth, still one more battle.
There won't be any more battles, she said flatly.
You mean you haven't heard?
What?
Don't you know the ship was hit?
Hit?
Then how could any of us be alive?
That's right.
She went back to her scrubbing. 4 squad bays, also the armor bay. There isn't a fighting suit left on the ship, and we can't fight in our underwear.
What squad bays? What happened to the people?
No survivors.
30 people.
Who was it?
All of the 3rd platoon, 1st squad of the 2nd platoon.
Al-Sadat, Busia, Maxwell, Negwalesko. My God.
30 deaders, and they don't have the slightest notion of what caused it. Don't know but that it may happen again any minute.
It wasn't a drone?
No, we got all of their drones. Got the enemy vessel, too. Nothing showed up on any of the sensors. Just blam, and 1/3 of the ship was torn to hell. We were lucky it wasn't the drive or the life support system.
I was hardly hearing her. Penworth, Labatt, Smithers, Christine and Frida. All dead. I was numb. She took a blade-type razor and a tube of gel out of her bag.
Be a gentleman and look the other way, she said.
Oh, here. She soaked a square of gauze in alcohol and handed it to me.
Be useful. Do her face.
I started, and without opening her eyes, Mary Gay said,
That feels good. What are you doing?
Being a gentleman, and useful, too. All personnel, attention, all personnel. There wasn't a squawk box in the pressure chamber, but I could hear it clearly through the door to the locker alcove. All personnel, echelon 6 and above, unless directly involved in medical or maintenance emergencies, report immediately to the assembly area.
I've got to go, Mary Gay.
She didn't say anything. I didn't know whether she had heard the announcement.
Estelle?
I addressed her directly, gentlemen be damned.
Will you?
Yes, I'll let you know as soon as we can tell.
Well,
it's going to be all right.
But her expression was grim and worried.
Now get going, she said softly.
By the time I picked my way out into the corridor, the box was repeating the message for the fourth time. There was a new smell in the air that I didn't want to identify.
Chapter 5.
Halfway to the assembly area, I realized what a mess I was and ducked into the head by the NCO lounge. Corporal Kamehameha was hurriedly brushing her hair.
William, what happened to you?
Nothing. I turned on a tap and looked at myself in the mirror. Dried blood smeared all over my face and tunic. It was Mary Gay, Corporal Potter. Her suit, well, evidently it got a crease.
Dead?
No, just badly. She's going into surgery.
Don't use hot water. You'll just set the stain.
Oh, right. I used the hot to wash my face and hand, dabbed at the tunic with cold. Your squad's just 2 bays down from Al's, isn't it?
Yes.
Did you see what happened?
No. Yes, not when it happened.
For the first time, I noticed that she was crying, big tears rolling down her cheeks and off her chin. Her voice was even, controlled. She pulled at her hair savagely.
It's a mess.
I stepped over and put my hand on her shoulder.
Don't touch me!
She flared and knocked my hand off with the brush.
Sorry. Let's go.
At the door to the head, she touched me lightly on the arm.
William?
She looked at me defiantly.
I'm just glad it wasn't me, you understand? That's the only way you can look at it.
I understood, but I didn't know that I believed her.
I can sum it up very briefly, the Commodore said in a tight voice, if only because we know so little. Some 10 seconds after we destroyed the enemy vessel, two objects, very small objects, struck the anniversary amidships. By inference, since they were not detected and we know the limits of our detection apparatus, we know that they were moving in excess of 9/10 of the speed of light. That is to say, more precisely, their velocity vector normal to the axis of the anniversary was greater than 9/10 of the speed of light. They slipped in behind the repeller fields. When the anniversary is moving at relativistic speeds, it is designed to generate two powerful electromagnetic fields, one centered about 5,000 kilometers from the ship, and the other about 10,000 clicks away, both in line with the direction of motion of the ship. These fields are maintained by a ramjet effect, energy picked up from interstellar gas as we mosey along. Anything big enough to worry about hitting, that is, anything big enough to see with a strong magnifying glass, goes through the first field and comes out with a very strong negative charge all over its surface. As it enters the second field, it's repelled away from the path of the ship. If the object is too big to be pushed around this way, we can sense it at a greater distance and maneuver out of its way.
I shouldn't have to emphasize how formidable a weapon this is.
When the anniversary was struck, our rate of speed with respect to the enemy was such that we traveled our own length every 10,000th of a second. Further, we were jerking around erratically with a constantly changing and purely random lateral acceleration. Thus, the objects that struck us must have been guided, not aimed, and the guidance system was self-contained, since there were no Torrens alive at the time they struck us. All of this in a package, no larger than a small pebble. Most of you are too young to remember the term future shock.
Back in the 70s, some people felt that technological progress was so rapid that people, normal people, couldn't cope with it, that they wouldn't have time to get used to the present before the future was upon them. A man named Toffler coined the term future shock to describe this situation. The Commodore could get pretty academic. We're caught up in a physical situation that resembles this scholarly concept. The result has been disaster, tragedy. And as we discussed in our last meeting, there is no way to counter it. Relativity traps us in the enemy's past. Relativity brings them from our future. We can only hope that next time the situation will be reversed, and all we can do to help bring that about is to try to get back to Stargate, and then to Earth, where specialists may be able to deduce something, some sort of counterweapon, from the nature of the damage. Now, we could attack the Torrens portal planet from space and perhaps destroy the base without using you infantry. But I think there would be a very great risk involved. We might be shot down by whatever hit us today and never return to Stargate with what I consider to be vital information. We could send a drone with a message detailing our assumptions about this new enemy weapon, but that might be inadequate, and the Force would be that much further behind, technologically. Accordingly, we have set a course that will take us around Yod 4, keeping the Collapsar as much as possible between us and the Torren base. We will avoid contact with the enemy and return to Stargate as quickly as possible. Incredibly, the Commodore sat down and kneaded his temples. All of you are at least squad or section leaders. Most of you have good combat records, and I hope that some of you will be rejoining the Force after your 2 years are up. Those of you who do will probably be made lieutenants and face your first real command. It is to these people I would like to speak for a few moments, not as your... as one of your commanders, but just as a senior officer and advisor. One cannot make command decisions simply by assessing the tactical situation and going ahead with whatever course of action will do the most harm to the enemy, with a minimum of death and damage to your own men and materiel. Modern warfare has become very complex, especially during the last century. Wars are won not by a simple series of battles won, but by a complex interrelationship among military victory, economic pressures, logistic maneuvering, access to the enemy's information, political postures, dozens, literally dozens of factors. I was hearing this, but the only thing that was getting through to my brain was that a third of our friends' lives had been snuffed out less than an hour before, and he was sitting up there giving us a lecture on military theory. So, sometimes you have to throw away a battle in order to help win the war. This is exactly what we are going to do. This was not an easy decision. In fact, it was probably the hardest decision of my military career, because on the surface, at least, it may look like cowardice. The logistic computer calculates that we have about a 62% chance of success should we attempt to destroy the enemy base. Unfortunately, we would have only a 30% chance of survival, as some of the scenarios leading to success involve ramming the portal planet with the anniversary at light speed. Jesus Christ! I hope none of you ever has to face such a decision. When we get back to Stargate, I will, in all probability, be court-martialed for cowardice under fire. But I honestly believe that the information that may be gained from analysis of the damage to the anniversary is more important than the destruction of this one Torren base.
He sat up straight.
More important than one soldier's career.
I had to stifle an impulse to laugh. Surely cowardice had nothing to do with his decision. Surely he had nothing so primitive and unmilitary as a will to live.
This ends Disc 3.